You're listening to Donuts and Top Cow.
Two great tastes that taste better together.
Thanks for listening. You are listening to Donuts and Top Cow, as I said in the beginning, and this is our episode number 16.
Woo woo! So sweet 16.
Yeah, how about that?
Sweet like a donut.
So we should just talk about good girl art today, right? Isn't it?
No.
We could pull it off, though.
I don't want to talk about good girl art until we get to episode 21.
I'm with you. Sign me up for that sentiment. I like that thought. So we are going to do some quick hits today, but first we want to thank this episode's sponsor, which is, once again, Nick. Thank you, Nick. Nick brought in some donuts for us. We actually altered our recording schedule so that we could take advantage of that. And Nick was up in a little north of here in Wisconsin and on his way back and offered to cater our show again. So I wanted to ask Nick a couple questions about the bakery. And what can you tell us about these fine pastries you brought in today?
They're from a little bakery in my hometown of Two Rivers, Wisconsin, called Jerry's Bakeries. It's a quaint hole in the wall, if you will, where you get the most lovely service of them being cold and wanting you to get out as soon as possible. When you ask for a recommendation, they just look at you like, leave.
We recommend you pay and go.
But they were affordable, $4.05.
Wow, that is pretty good. It is kind of funny how the price of donuts has been shifting over. I mean, I remember $3 for a dozen donuts, but it's been a long time since you could get that.
Yeah, I don't think I ever quite remember that. I think I remember about 50 cents a piece. But
yeah, I don't know.
I just did the math on this now, and it's more than 75 cents a piece.
But right? Still good, because you go to a gas station now, they charge you almost a buck. You go to, like, Lane's Bakery is actually not too bad. I think they're still about 65 cents a donut, but...
Oh, that's awesome.
That is really good.
Is that the same for their apple fritters?
Yeah, they priced the same.
Oh, sweet.
And it's kind of fun.
Awesome.
Because you go in, and at that bakery counter, you've got some Formica tables on the right side, and pretty much all the old men in town come in every morning and drink Johnson Brothers coffee and eat a donut and talk for about 4 hours, so...
Johnson Brothers is some tasty stuff.
It can be.
I worked with them when I worked at Meeting Grounds.
I had them. I used them in the first hotel that I ran here in Madison, and I actually kicked them out after about 6 months and brought Starbucks in. But what do I know? You know, I was from out of market and wanted to get some business travelers in. So, and in any case, Nick's going to join us today, and feel free, Nick, to chime in anytime you've got something you want to add, because we're grateful for having the extra thinking. We're going to do some quick hits on books, and as we record this, we are 24 hours from Free Comic Book Day, and we wanted to first hit on Top Cow's free comic book, which is Darkness 2 Confession. And it's a tie-in / lead-in for the forthcoming Darkness 2 video game.
Oh, yeah, where you get to do crazy things like control darkness, tentacly, snake-type attacking things. I don't remember what they call it. It's quad control or something? I don't know, because you're like shooting guns with two hands and controlling two of the tentacles, and you get to do cool stuff like throw barrels or car doors or...
Yeah, and I'm not a gamer, although my stepson is. And I will be getting Darkness 2 on Xbox 360, and maybe we'll bring him in and get his opinion on the playability.
Sweet. I wouldn't mind coming over to play that, too, because I'm not much of a gamer either. I mean, I have a PlayStation hooked up.
But they're fun.
An original PlayStation, that is. Yeah. And a Super Nintendo.
I'm not sure that Darkness 2 is coming out in SNES or in PS1, but...
Oh, it would be so awesome if it did.
It would be kind of pixelated, at least. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be okay with that.
Darkness 2 Confession is written by Matt Hawkins and Philip Sablik, and the script, so the words were written by Philip Sablik, but the story was developed by Matt Hawkins and Philip. Art by Michael Prasard. We get to see Michael Prasard draw darkness again. And Romano Molinar with Martin Montiel. Colors by our friend Sonny Go and Ivan Nunes. So they had a lot of people working on this book. And letters are by the old standby.
Troy Pateri.
Troy Pateri.
Well, I think part of the reason it's because there's the six, I mean, not to totally just jump to the middle of the book, there's two double page spreads, I think, that are the Molinar and all the guys that are listed second. Because, yeah, the Broussard, Sonny Go pages are very, very definitively by those two. And, man, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, the artwork is really good. It's a nice cross-section of the type of books Top Cow's putting out right now. The story is a lot of background and exposition, and it was kind of funny because I was just reading it kind of like as a darkness book, but about 3-4 pages into it, I really was taken into the video game world. I mean, it's really written a lot like the intros to a video game where they give you the background and all that. A lot of narrative, not a lot of dialogue, and as taking it through the scenes, it's done flashback style, but it really felt like set up screens for a video game.
I actually hadn't really thought of it that way, but after you mentioned that, it definitely makes sense. I see it, and I think it works, though. I mean,
it does. You know, and it's reminiscent. I don't know if you remember that, but in some of the earlier graphical role-playing games, Sierra did a lot of games on PC, and there were a couple of detective and murder mystery type games, and that had that similar kind of feel to start it off, because you'd get a good 10-15 minutes of content before you started getting into the game playing, and they weren't shoot 'em up game playing. It was more like trying to resolve things and figure things out, but it gave that kind of feel more than reading, you know, a run of one of Phil Hester's Darkness books.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I reading through it. I haven't read all, like the entire run of the Darkness. But a lot of it to me, I think it's well done. But it kind of summarizes the first issue of the Darkness, and then kind of the end of the first volume around issue 40, and then volume 2, number 1. And it doesn't really lead into any of the Phil Hester stuff, which it doesn't need to. I mean, obviously, it's designed probably more for, oh, hey, you know, we have a Darkness comic. By the way, though, you know, if you're going to play the game, check this out, too. And it kind of works on all those levels, I think.
The only thing, I think so, too, and I think that it's pretty good for somebody who wants a fairly quick orientation to Jackie Estacado and what he's about. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more of the Darkness powers and the Darklings, and it seemed to me that if you have a general familiarity of the Darkness, then a lot of the Darkling scenes make sense to you. But if you're not, you may be wondering what these are and how he's bringing them out. And they allude to it in the script, but I don't know so much in the storytelling of the art that it comes out.
Well, that does kind of bring us to something else then, sort of. Because in theory, if you're just going to talk about what you're showing anyways, what's the point in talking about it if you're just going to show it? So, you know, it's one of those show, don't tell, tell, don't show. And I think they kind of work well together. At the same time, as kind of a prelude, it's, you know, they're talking about all this stuff that the Darkness can do, juxtapositioning it with the more emotional bent that some of this is kind of on.
Well, it definitely gets into his motivations, you know, after kind of some of the the regret. It opens up. He's at a graveside. He's at Jenny's graveside, which is kind of his touchstone to humanity for a brief moment, and then he went totally into the Darkness afterward. But it is a one-shot. If you have a chance to pick it up, I recommend it, especially if you're curious about the Darkness and aren't really familiar with it. It'll get you up to speed on what Jackie's about, at least.
I did kind of think of where I was going to go with some of that now that I think another couple minutes. By not showing necessarily all of the darkness, the darklings, all the stuff it can do, anyone that's going to play the game, this is just going to kind of whet their appetite for it. And even the same with people that might, you know, be like, oh, this story's interesting. Because then when it comes time to reading the ongoing adventures of the darkness, there's going to be plenty of darklings and darkness stuff and sometimes ripping off of chest plates. And
yeah, you know, and that's a good point. I guess I look at Free Comic Book Day, and this is different from what I think Top Cow's trying to do. I look at Free Comic Book Day as how am I going to get a little bit of interest so that they buy books from our company. And this, obviously they want to do that, but it really is more how are you going to get into this universe so that you'll want to buy and play the game. And, you know, that's there's probably a lot of profit in that, so it makes sense to do it. And Top Cow, I think, has a history of multimedia promotions. You know, they produce movies and they produce video games, and they really are getting into that as much as the comic books probably.
I was actually talking with a customer last night. There's a reason that Continuity Associates didn't do anywhere near as many comics and did a lot of advertising work. The money in comics isn't always there. Yeah. Not everyone's, you know, selling a piece of original artwork for $450,000. So
you should bundle a trade with the game then. Do a curse number one with the darkness two.
Huh. Yeah, I'm not going to do that here.
Charge an extra $5 and
Top Cow could do that.
Yeah.
For small stores like us, because we've actually had people ask if they could order video games, and we do have a distributor we can get them from. Problem is, the shipping itself costs more than our profit margin on a video game.
Wow.
Now, I mean, sure, we could go, oh, we're going to have Pokemon Black and White. And, you know, we're probably pretty safe ordering a few copies of it and paying the shipping on it, because we'll make that back if we probably even just tweeted, oh, hey, looking for these? We have copies of them. Yeah. But beyond that, I mean, it's tough. But, of course, but speaking in more general Free Comic Book Day stuff, some publishers, you know, just the, oh, we're going to reprint something and give you a preview of something, none of which is new material, which I kind of understand, because some stuff that is original even goes unlooked, but it's...
Well, and as a comic company, you minimize your investment a little more. Yeah. You know, we all have to be fiscally responsible, and this way you've got content so that, you know, you don't have to pay your creators the base page rate to put together new material. So props to Top Cow for investing in fresh material for Free Comic Day. I always like those that are able to do that.
And unlike some origin stories, it's not... I mean, this isn't... it's sort of an overview of an origin in some respects. But even when it comes to, say, like DC doing the Green Lantern Secret Origin book and the Green Lantern movie, it's... I've had enough of origins, you know? It's... Those things aren't for me. You know, I don't need... Oh, here's the third time we're going to tell the origin in comics, and now we're going to tell the origin in a movie when we just told the origin in an animated movie less than 5 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm scared of the Spider-Man reboot for that reason. I'm scared of the Superman reboot for that reason. I just don't need any more.
Well, and it's not even the reboots. I mean, every movie, it's like, oh, we have to tell this character's origin.
Yeah.
No, you don't. I never saw more than, I think, 5 minutes of Spider-Man 3. Did we really need Sandman's origin? I mean, once you get to the third movie, haven't you established that people get powers in different ways?
Well, look at some great first movies. Raiders of the Lost Ark didn't get us into how Indiana Jones... We didn't even know who he was. He was just running through the temple, or yeah, through the pyramid.
Maybe when they do a reboot, they should show him going to college.
Yeah.
But then they're going to have to do flashbacks to him going to elementary school.
Well, they did that on Fox, didn't they? Didn't they do that TV series?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that was kind of the whole, what was that, young Indiana Jones? That kind of is the concept of that, though. But, I mean, doing a movie and going, oh, we need to show the origin again.
I just ask movie producers, just give a thought to the intelligence of the audience. And maybe it's kind of fun to learn about people as they go along. Because now, the big sales and demand for comics are, number one, well, what's wrong with picking up Witchblade 120. You know, what's wrong with picking up a book that's well into it? You should be able to... You know, when I started reading when I was a kid, you couldn't get contiguous runs of comics. You got what was on the spinner rack, if you were lucky to see a new one, and you just read it. And if it was in the middle of a story arc, you might be bummed, but you'd still get into it and know, and still want to buy more of those, and not really think about trying to be a completist or in, you know, consecutive order.
Yeah. Plus, we have the internet now.
You can kind of... There you go.
But I remember, you know, picking up Marvel stuff late 80s, early 90s, you know, there was a little paragraph that told you the general concept of what the character was. Oh, Steve Rogers, Super Soldier Serum, became Captain America.
Right.
Fights, you know, Nazi bad guys. Oh, that's what this guy's about. Cool, now what adventure is he going to have? And to bring this all back to Top Cow.
Top Cow does a good job with this.
Yeah, there's the little previouslys, you know, in the books, and I think those are enough. You know what the concept is. And
when they introduce characters, sometimes they'll do the name and the power. A lot of times they'll introduce a character quickly and then show them using their power. I'm thinking about when Cyberforce was introduced into the Artifact series. You got to see what they did right away. You know, you may not know who Karen or Velocity was, but you got to see what she was all about right away.
But she's smarmy.
Well, you got to see some of that too.
I love how Ron Mars scripts Velocity. I just want to say that right now.
And now the miniseries is done. We should cover that in an episode soon.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. But speaking of Artifacts, though, I have actually spoken to a couple customers who almost felt like Artifacts was a little too much. Because we've kind of talked about how it's a good entry point, you know, characters introduced well. Some people were still didn't quite think it was as easy to get into maybe as I'd led them to believe. I don't want to speak for anyone else. But at the same time, I mean, it is an event with a lot of characters. And, you know, sure, they may not have had 20 years of experience with those characters, because go figure, a lot of them haven't been around 20 years. Well, actually, no, none of them.
You know what?
I'm doing my math here real quick. And it's like, you know, if you didn't have 20 years of experience with the DC Universe, what would anyone think of Blackest Night?
True.
I mean,
a lot of the things wouldn't have as big an impact as it might have since you knew who was coming back to life.
I'd say they wouldn't have any.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you'd still see zombies coming back to life.
Well, yeah. But reading Artifacts as, you know, just, oh, it's an event book. I think there's a good job done of this is who these characters are. And this is what they do. Blackest Night, you're like, oh, there's characters here, I think.
Well, comparison, you know, I think that Brian Rountree does a nice job with the summaries in the back of Artifacts and at the right times to kind of fill you in on a little bit of the background. And then you have the two-page spreads scripted by Ron Mars and then drawn by various artists that show you one artifact wielder at a time, which is helpful. And in contrast, talking about Blackest Night, you had the diary pages in the back, but all that really kind of gave you is a little bit of Black Hand background made him so twisted. But still, you're playing, and in some people like that because you're not trying to play to the general public, but you are playing to the hardcore invested comic fan.
And I think that's kind of what I realized I was going towards was Artifacts is much easier to get into if you aren't the I've been following this universe for 20 years type.
Yeah.
Which I think the industry needs more of and is better for the industry. Also, those Black Hand pages I thought were not laid out very well for readability.
I agree.
So I didn't read them.
I think that's probably the majority. I wasn't reading them either, although I did hear a review on another podcast on Comic Geek Speak. They were reviewing one of them, and Peter Rio said, folks, you've got to read these backup pages. They add so much to your enjoyment of the story. And I don't agree as fiercely as he did, but I agree in general that it's pretty good to read the backup material. I will say that for sure for the Artifact series, that they put a lot of thought into the backup material, and it's worth it. And Artifact 7 just came out, And we're going to touch base on Artifact 7, and I have been promising that we're going to be really spoiler-free on this one, because there are a couple things that would be major spoilers. I have been looking for adjectives with this one, and I really enjoyed this book. There was a lot going on. It starts off basically hunter-killers brought in to kind of do cleanup after they destroy the church that they've been fighting in. Cyberforce has been fighting with the, you know, the good guys that we're terming them, Sarah and Jackie and Patience and some of the other Angelus and the artifacts wielders. So they destroyed the church we were at, and at the end of the last issue, basically we all found out, hey, wait a minute, we're fighting each, we're pitted against each other to be a distraction, and that turns out to be pretty much true. So this moves forward. The one thing I guess I will say about this Artifact 7 is that I'm skeptical about what I'm saying. I've been pretty vocal about this. We find out who the survivor is, although I'm not ready to buy into that. And that's about as far as I'm going
to
go.
I am more than ready to buy into it. And I will tell you when we are not recording. I think because if I explain it, it will go into territory that will defeat the purpose of non-spoiler.
And that's true. So if that didn't make you want to pick it up, I don't know what would. And the artwork is kinetic again. I guess that's the best adjective I can give to Wills Portacio's art is it's very sketchy. It's very motion-driven. I've seen some back and forth about where people are going, but I think that the artists that they're picking for each section of the story has been really good. Michael Brassard was excellent for those first four issues. I think Portacio is really an action chaos kind of artist, and so he's been a good choice. Now I'm really looking forward to seeing where the story goes when Jeremy Hahn takes over in issue 9.
He's done some awesome covers. I don't remember, this one in this Darkness Free Comic Book Day, this one?
Yeah.
That is awesome.
It is. I'm looking really forward to that. I do not like the A cover for Artifact 7. I don't understand it. It just seems, and maybe it didn't get executed. It either got executed the way they wanted it to or didn't, but the from above shot of Sarah holding the head of Aphrodite 4, it just doesn't work. It's misproportioned, and I think that
little
they're trying
goofy
to get a
perspective.
Yeah, I think the perspective didn't work, and it also took me a little while to believe that that was really Sarah because of how. But then again, you know, she was in a high emotional state, so I guess the Witchblade reflects the control that she's under at the time.
Well, and I mean, up to this point, you know, Aphrodite's a cyborg type androidy deal. I don't remember which one of those fancy sci-fi words I want to use right now. You know, whatever that is, she is a fake person.
And because of that, she can be repaired, or sometimes she can regenerate. So I know that we haven't, in this issue, Aphrodite 4 still plays a role post Sarah ripping her head off and taking the Coin of Solomon. So we have another dual artifact wielder, because she has taken the Coin of Solomon from Aphrodite 4, and we saw that in issue 6. So
I think I'm going to go a little slightly spoilery here.
I think you can go there.
Dealing with the Coin of Solomon. What if that's not the Coin of Solomon? Because I don't recall seeing it react with the Witchblade at all.
Hmm.
I may be wrong. It may have been not clear artwork. I may also have to go find... Yeah. I mean, at least in issue 7 here, a couple pages in, there's no reaction to the Witchblade. It looks like it would be the Coin of Solomon.
Wow, that's an interesting
thought. But what if
thought.
It's not?
And that would make sense because...
Of other stuff we see in this issue?
Well, and also of other stuff we see, and also the survivor has been almost too calculating and trying to get all the artifacts together that I can't see him giving one up to somebody he's seeing as an antagonist, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. I didn't think of that. That's pretty good. So Artifact 7, I give it a thumb up. I think that you need to go pick it up if you haven't yet. And we're going to probably take a closer look at it when we get closer to number 8 coming out.
Yeah, because so. the more we sit here and I'm like, oh, I want to keep saying stuff, but...
More than any issue so far, we've got a lot to talk about, so...
I think so.
Pick it up, and we'd love to engage you in the conversation. So you have our email. It's dtcpodcast@gmail.com.
We are also on Twitter, @dtcpodcast. We also have a fancy schmancy Facebook page, which is kind of fun. Though I've realized John and I can't post as John and I on there.
I know, we gotta identify ourselves if we're going to.
Yeah, I tested that one time and I'm like, okay, I had a feeling that was gonna happen.
Because I wanted to post a comment to the comment as just me, you know, my own John Grigas, but instead
and thank you to everyone who has followed us and liked us and whatnot so far. It's appreciated. Also, we're on iTunes, and miraculously, I went to check our reviews today, and they disappeared. But if you guys wanted to go give us a review, you know, even if it's just a short sentence, it doesn't have to be, you know, overly positive. It could be, you know, just
tell us what you think.
Yeah, it's pretty decent.
Let people know what to expect if they're going to download it, and we appreciate any feedback.
And rate it, because we get enough ratings, and then we get an average rating. But I did notice when I went to search for it, I think I just typed in donuts. Mm-hmm. We were the 6th suggested search term.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I don't quite know what that means, but...
We're number 6. Woo!
We're not number 7. Oh, and actually, since Nick is writing... I don't know what Nick's writing down right now, but there is something that says Artifacts 13 Artist. And on Twitter the other day, maybe it was yesterday... and I don't know which account it was. I assume it was the Top Cow account. Something was said, like, I think it was in some podcast. Someone said they wanted to see...
it was iFanboy.
iFanboy, okay. Mark Silvestri on Batman. And they were like, well, what would you like to see Mark Silvestri do? I was actually on Facebook, so of course I replied with Artifacts 13.
Absolutely.
I don't think... I can't imagine anyone else could draw Artifacts 13.
Oh, Nick thinks he can, but he might be able to. I haven't seen Nick draw.
No. I have a suggestion. Oh,
you got one. Oh, good.
All right, tell us.
Since you guys have been debating this the last couple episodes, I'm sitting there and you're like, I don't want to say hellbent, but definitely sure that Silvestri is going to be the guy. So I'm just going to go for the long shot and say Dale Keown. I haven't seen him do anything in a while, and he's very much tied to Top Cow with doing Darkness in the Past and other... I know, it's a long shot, but...
That'd work.
But it's the first ever ginormous Top Cow event. I think it has to be Mark Silvestri.
I don't know.
Dale Keown, though, would probably be my second pick. Definitely. At this point.
Oh, for sure. And all I know is there's evidence to suggest that issue 13... has not yet been completed as far as the script goes, because Ron Mars tweeted out that he was writing Artifacts yesterday. So,
all right.
So that's why I'm holding out some hope for various things coming. I know he's got the whole story in his mind, but you just never know what the twist may come.
Yeah, true. And plans change, obviously, because we actually, I don't know if we've ever heard about what happened to the bumped Artifacts number 1/2 issue that was supposed to be Free Comic Book Day book this year. Though, that also reminds me of something else I was going to mention, Artifacts related, with the 2-page origin stories. Because Wade was in yesterday, and I'd known this, but it reminded me that I should maybe talk about it a little bit. But the those 2-page origin stories are not in the first Artifacts trade. My guess is... most of them will end up in the second Artifacts trade to maybe make it a similar page count to the first trade, which had the added zero-issue stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
So
that makes sense, and that's really useful stuff. And one thing, just kind of as a segue back to Free Comic Day, our next episode, maybe not the next one, but if not, then the one after that, is going to give a profile of the Artifacts wielders, and we're going to... solicit some volunteers from some of your customers, Josh, to play the roles of the various Artifact wielders. We'll have some words that probably written by Ron Mars that are used in Artifact Zero and some of these backups as scripts for people to read. And, you know, I'm thinking you're talking about the accessibility of artifacts. Maybe we just put that episode on a CD and give it to your customers when they buy Artifacts 8 so they can catch up on who everybody is.
I think we could do that.
So watch out for that. That'll be a lot of fun. I did get some response from a couple of people who saw me tweet out the fact, and they want to come in and give a shot at that. So we're looking forward to some of those recordings. So now, we typically, as a philosophy, like to have about a half-hour episode. We feel like it matches most people's commute. It certainly matches our time as far as putting things together. And one of the pieces of feedback we had in the last day or so is that our episode was good, but it was too short. And that happened to be a comment thrown out by Troy Hickman. So I wanted to extend this episode a little bit to talk about Troy Hickman's Twilight Guardian, which just wrapped up with issue number 4. I was surprised, actually. I read it, and I saw it was basically ended with a lot of, not questions, because the story got completed, but it ended with wanting more or expecting a little more story, and I saw it was the end, and then I thought, well, the end doesn't mean the end, does it? And I turned to the front, and it is a 4-issue miniseries. So I was surprised to see it was just 4 issues. Now, I think the other thing that tipped me off is that it was advertised in back for the trade coming soon from Top Cow, issues 1 through 4, plus the pilot season issue. So when that gets solicited, we'll definitely encourage people to buy it. I really enjoyed it. It's gotten some good buzz, particularly for issues 2 and 3. I thought issue 4 was satisfying for sure, although I had a little more fun with issue 2 and 3. And one thing, and I know that Josh basically is kind of waiting for it to be complete before going through it. I don't know if you've had a chance to read much more than the pilot issue, but the one thing that I do want to let people know is the content in the back is really telling to the story sometimes. Sometimes it's telling to what's going on in the creative minds. And Troy has been writing up kind of a little letter of his own to the readers. And the one in number 4 is pretty compelling. He tells a story about some of the thoughts behind Twilight Guardian and what could be motivating the Twilight Guardian. And in the midst of the challenges and the twists and the turns and the successes and disappointments, how does the Twilight Guardian keep going and why does she keep going? And one of his quotes is, "In the midst of unsolved mysteries, we hang on for dear life to that one thing that's a certainty." And if we find those touchstones, maybe it's a practice, maybe it's a habit, maybe it's just something that we feel that we're compelled to do. He has a fairly touching write-up about his nephew who had been killed while serving in the military overseas, and that kind of informs some of the motivation and some of the mystery of what can go on in people's lives, what drives them or what makes them make the decisions that they make. So if you're not buying in the single issues and waiting for the trade, consider buying the issues, because that's the kind of content that you don't get in the back of your book usually.
And if John's little recap there intrigued you at all, the website westfieldcomics.com should have pilot season issues of Twilight Guardian still available. I saw them in the warehouse the other day. Nick actually has some questions.
Excellent.
Not Twilight Guardian questions.
Why
are you putting your hands out like that?
We are going to talk about Twilight Guardian more once the trade comes out.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. But yeah, let's do some questions.
Sounds great.
So last time you asked me just about how I got into Top Cow on that, and I was thinking more and more, just because Josh pushed on that first Ron Mars trade. It was like a perfect price point. I mean, it's really dirt cheap, either $5 or $10, depending where you get it.
Yeah, $4.99. Yeah. Yeah, right. $4.99 at a comic retailer.
Yeah. So, and you guys were talking more about origins in that before, and in there's no hint at where she got the Witchblade from, anything about, but it didn't matter. I didn't care. I have no idea where she got it from. Could have been from a hobo or found it in the garbage can. I have no idea. This is brand new to me. And what Ron Mars is doing reminds me, actually, of when I got into Stormwatch about 10 years ago with Warren Ellis, where I never read an issue of Stormwatch before that, but just jumped in with the first couple trades. And it's just amazing what one creator can do to a world that's already established and take it to a new level, more depth, put his own twists and turns to it. And that's what I think I'm going to really enjoy more and more as I catch up and go into Broken Trinity and Artifacts, because it looks like he has a plan. He's going to try to do something, kind of like Stormwatch was very common superhero team, blah, blah, blah. But then what everybody keeps praising Ron Mars in the introduction is he can do anything. It doesn't have to be superhero. It could be pirate stories or action adventure or mystery or whatever. So I guess one of my few questions is, how did she get the Witchblade? I have no idea, because where I'm up to in the trades, I don't know.
Josh looks like he's itching to take this one.
Conveniently, we're coming up on a Witchblade anniversary here, and in issue 144, Ron will be retelling the 8-issue origin in one issue. That's what some people like to call compression.
You mean we're not going to tell him?
There was this guy named Irons who had been around a long, long time, hundreds of years. And the Witchblade, for some reason, was basically after the Witchblade and kind of set up. Mind you, I'm doing all of this from memory, so I'm probably getting something wrong.
And it's in the Witchblade 1-8.
Witchblade Origins, Volume 1.
Oh, see, I just downloaded the digital copies from DriveThru Comics.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't just do it, but so I just know it as the...
Okay, yeah, issues 1-8.
So it is, or yeah. So it's the original ones. And yeah, you want to know about Kenneth Irons and the whole Irons family, then...
That's where we get Kenneth Irons, Ian Nottingham, but basically it was kind of... Kenneth Irons had been pulling the strings somewhat to kind of set some stuff up, because eventually he's trying to get the Witchblade for himself. Like, he's got a whole bunch of other... Like, he's got a museum...
Like, it's one of those that...
Of, like, all these Witchblades in the past type stuff.
He hasn't been able to wield the Witchblade. It chooses who it...
Well, that's the other goofy issue that, yeah.
I think with one exception, or no, wait, now I'm thinking of Alan Moore's Promethea. Never mind.
Ian Nottingham had Excalibur, which was eventually revealed to be a fragment of the Witchblade. So that could kind of count. Maybe.
I don't know. It's a rich history, and I agree with you. I think Ron has done an amazing job of pulling the whole Top Cow universe together and making it more than what it was. Mm-hmm.
So I guess, I'm just not sure since Ron Mars has jumped on, is it included in the normal Image universe with, like, Invincible, Savage Dragon? Has that touched upon at all? I know in the past
No.
It was a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit here and there. To my knowledge, and Josh is actually helping a customer right now, but he could probably answer better than I, but from what I've seen, and I've basically read everything Top Cow since about Witchblade 80, they basically don't cross with the other Image universe unless you get something like a War of the Independents or something like that, which is a major crossover of multiple publishers. And then there are some Top Cow books that cross over with other publishers. One of the things I picked up last week that we'll talk about in a future episode is Magdalena Daredevil, which is a pretty interesting story. But as far as I've seen, at least in the last few years, the Top Cow universe seems to be contained just to the Top Cow universe. We'll have Josh answer when he gets back if there's a different answer than that.
If there's a different? Okay. So, unfortunately, I jumped ahead and read the Angelus trade and was very confused because I'm only at Witchblade 100 where...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, when I was staring at it, maybe this has been addressed somewhere within the comics, but is Angelus just Angel Us? Because I stare at the title, the name, and it just seems so...
I believe it was at the C2E2 panel that I did take donuts to that a lot of people pronounce it wrong, partially because of Buffy. So it's not Angelus. I think it's just Angelus, which is probably, I assume, close to what the Latin pronunciation of that would be. I think is the intent there.
And the one thing, it's kind of interesting because I did just reread Angelus number 1 from that miniseries and was kind of thinking to myself, how would somebody who doesn't really know anything about Danny really take some of this stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I really, really enjoyed that series. I think it was good. One thing that's good about it is that when he got to issues 2 and 3, they talked more about what the Angelus power is and what it's about. And then you got back more into the interpersonal relationship and the fight against Sabine. And I don't know how accessible it is without reading through those Witchblade, you know, right through War of the Witchblades to really get an intimate connection with Danny Baptiste.
I think Ron's allowed one every so often that maybe doesn't work as well as some of the other volume ones. Yeah, I'm just going to go with that.
I'd still recommend it to anybody, but maybe they need a little. You almost need like the background material to be put in the front couple of pages as opposed to
yeah.
at the end of the book.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So no, I just have a follow up to that because I had an idea generally. What I shouldn't say general. I knew it existed because I have read The Darkness, the first two trades, and there's one where they jump ahead in the future, where the darkness has overtaken the whole darkness world. And then she or whatever, whoever has the power is be pretty much locked up. And so I guess maybe I've never understood darkness. I read the first trade that Garth Ennis did years and years ago. But is darkness bad and Angelus good? Because it does not feel that way.
That's
reading
one of
that
my
miniseries.
Favorite questions.
Because they're kind of angels, but they're not. And well, they seem to be kind of schmucks.
Well, you know, what's kind of interesting with, and you know, and interrupt me and join in anytime, Josh, if I go off on a tangent, but what I liked with what Ron Mars has done with the artifacts in general, and the darkness in Angelus specifically, is they've really pitted them against each other. It's almost a yin to a yang, but they exist in order to destroy each other. So anytime in Ron Mars' run, anytime Jackie Estacado came around and the former Angelus was around, then all of a sudden the Angelus, you know, it was basically like they're rolling along, they're interacting. Oh, wait, there's the darkness. It's like, get them! You know, it's like, interrupt everything that's going on because I'm just existing to take this darkness down, and vice versa. And that's what is interesting between about the origin of the Witchblade, because the origin of the Witchblade is that it's the offspring of the darkness in Angelus. And so it's
the balance.
It's the balance, right. Yeah, that's a better way to put it. So, and I've always liked that juxtaposition of, you know, you just think, well, he's darkness, it's the devil, it's bad, it's the Angelus, it's the heavens, it's good, but it's not, it's a lot more complicated than that.
It kind of takes out the religious aspect of those, and what it really, it's more two primal forces constantly at odds with each other than it is good and evil.
Because otherwise you might see the Magdalena working for the Angelus.
Exactly, where it's not that. And I guess to maybe flip some of that on its head, there are times when the darkness power is being used for good, and it seems like the Angelus power is being used for evil, but really it's kind of... And while they do have some influence... Because one's dark, one's light, it's kind of how those things are used. Kind of like a gun can be used to kill people, but it can be used as a deterrent to protect people, too. They're primal forces that are, however well they're being used, they're really, it's how they're wielded.
And you're right, because since Danny Baptiste took the Angelus, there's a lot less of an adversarial position with the darkness.
Yeah.
So it's shifted quite a bit. And I guess as books, you know, I lean towards liking Jackie more than Danny, although I have positive feelings about both of them. But I like the Angelus books because they're so brightly colored.
Well, I was going to say there's that. But Jackie's got a deeper... history. I mean, Jackie's been around since, I want to say, 96. Danny's been around since, I'm probably going to not get the date completely correct, but I'm going to go with 2003, 2004. And Danny's really only had one person writer, which is Ron, which possibly in this instance... maybe it doesn't have the benefit of a bunch of people working on Jackie and refining him over time. Because, I mean, Garth Ennis, Paul Jenkins, even Ron himself have all written The Darkness. And now with Phil, you know, it's kind of maybe there was a concept that's been refined, whereas with Danny, it's kind of she's refined, but it's only been refined by one person. So it's maybe it's a little more pure vision of the creator's intent, but it doesn't have the refining that Jackie's had. Kapow.
Cool point. I like it. Well, thanks for hanging with us this week. We look forward to sending you out some more shows. We would like to thank our sponsor, Westfield Comics, for giving us the space and supporting what we do. Westfield Comics can be found at www.westfieldcomics.com. There are also two retail stores in Madison, Wisconsin, one near downtown on the east side and one on the west side of Madison. If you happen to come through Wisconsin, please stop by the east side location. Say hi to Josh. Talk a little Top Cow.
Especially if you're Troy Hickman.
Hope
this one's long enough for
Troy's
you.
Troy's got an open invitation. Yeah, we're going. This is about at my limit of length, I think, for a show. So we're looking at you, man. So thank you for listening and have a great week.
Good journey.